You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. I've always been a little bit nervous about farmed salmon. It's not the idea of fish being in pens that bothers me in the abstract. The thing that's always kind of bothered me is that I know that they put fake coloring on it because they have difficulty replicating the natural diet, which offers the red color of a salmon. So they put dye in it, and that's always kind of like weirded me out. Like, how is that real food? Well, I think that after you listen to today's segment, if you go through with this, you may actually have other reasons to look askance at farm salmon. We have with us on the line an accidental activist who started out as a marine biologist studying orcas, but when her orcas disappeared, she had to figure out why. That led her down a rabbit hole. Her name is Alexandra Morton. Her book is Not on My Watch, How a Renegade Whale Biologist Took on Governments and Industry to Save Wild Salmon. She is based up in the inlets of British Columbia, has been for most of her life now. Alexandra, tell us how you got involved in this, all the way from San Diego studying orcas to end up studying salmon and sea lice in British Columbia.
I did not want to become anything like an activist. As a girl, I read every single book on people that went into the wilderness to study wild animals. And this was my dream. Dr. Jane Goodall has been my role model since I was, you know, about 15 years old, to actually go into the wilderness and design your life to move into their environment and learn about them. And in particular, my interest was in communication between animals, non-human languages. And for that, I wanted to study a large-brained animal. And that sort of left me with three choices: elephants, primates, or the large dolphins. I just was fascinated with animal life from the very beginning. I started studying, I picked whales, and I started studying two killer whales or orcas in a tank in Los Angeles. And these were remarkable creatures. I learned so much. I would spend like 12 hours during the day one week, and then the next week I would arrive at the oceanarium and spend 12 hours at night.
Hey.
Yes.
Okay.
So after a few years of working with these captive whales, I witnessed the birth and death of several of the calves that the female was producing, which was absolutely heartbreaking. The female was very dedicated to her babies, but because the tank was circular, she spent all her time trying to nudge her little one away from the edge of the tank so it would stop hitting the wall and, you know, potentially break its jaw. But in the process, the baby never learned to nurse because the mother couldn't glide and roll over and present her mammary glands to the little whale. And I realized if I'm going to study communication in these animals, I need to go into the wild.
Now, when you say whale, we're talking orcas here, right?
We're talking orcas, okay, which are really the largest dolphin.
Right.
And at just about that time, which was in the late 70s, researchers in British Columbia were finding out that every pod of orcas speaks a different dialect. And I had now spent several years learning the dialect of the two whales in Los Angeles. And so I wanted to try to find their family, the whales that used the same sounds. And so I contacted a remarkable researcher in the government of Canada. His name was Dr. Michael Bigg. And he was very generous. He sent me pictures of her family, and he said, go to Alert Bay, which is on the coast of British Columbia, in August, and you'll find them. And so with these instructions, I set out on this great adventure, put an inflatable boat in the back of my little pickup truck, and with a friend, we drove from Los Angeles, crossed the border into Canada, and up to this remote fishing village called Alert Bay on the north end of Vancouver Island, and pumped up the boat. And we actually found the whales on the first night. They showed up right off the dock, which was not unusual. This was part of their daily routine. And one thing led to the next, and I was soon living in British Columbia. My goal was to find a place to really settle down that these whales visited. And in 1984, with my young husband, who I met in Canada, we found a place called Echo Bay in the Broughton Archipelago, which was just perfect. By that time, we had a little boy, and we were looking for a place with other children and some form of communication and the whales and protected waters. And Echo Bay had all of those things. And so, yeah, I embarked on this project to follow the whales every single day I could find them. Well, a few years later, about 5 years later, the first salmon farm showed up, and I thought, oh, good idea. I thought it would bring more families, keep our little one-room school open. It looked completely harmless to me. But it was in just a few years of the industry just not only arriving, but now just like filling every bay in the whole area with applications and
Could I just stipulate that of necessity, there are some fascinating parts of your story that you're glossing over, but that's okay. Just for a potential reader, I want them to know.
You want to know?
No. What I said is I want the potential reader to know that there is much more in the book that
much more.
Oh, my goodness. It's an incredible story. There is an awful lot of story here between the lines of what Alexandra is telling us right now. Keep going.
Yes, well, I think you're referring to the fact that I lost my husband.
Well, more than that. I mean, that's part of it. I didn't want to force you there, but it's just the adventure is kind of like movie material.
Thanks. Yeah, so those first few years were just incredible. Like every day out with the orcas, I was learning something new, but I also was learning how to run a chainsaw and raise a child in a really remote area with no telephones, no roads, no 911. There's nobody to call.
Well, your kid says that he was raised in a zodiac.
I know. Poor guy. He was very good about it.
What's he up to now? Because I'm just picturing like this kid raised in a zodiac. He has to be, you know, eccentric in some way himself.
He's a rocket scientist.
All right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. So keep going with your story. I didn't mean to derail you entirely, but.
Sure. So, yeah, then the fishermen came to me because I worked closely with the federal government on the whales, not officially, but just in communication. And they said, could you tell the government that they're putting these farms in all the wrong places? Basically, they're placing them on the vital organs of that archipelago where the upwellings were, where the wild salmon and the prawns and the rock cod were all collecting. These were important commercial species to my neighbors. And they were very worried. And so I wrote the first letter in 1989.
Oh, my gosh. And you wrote a lot of letters.
I wrote 10,000 pages of letters. In fact,
did you save all the text? I mean, do you have that?
No, it's many, many computers ago. Our post office, the mail came by seaplane a couple of times a week. And the postmistress for a while there said that I was keeping the post office open. Because this was before emails. And so every single letter I wrote, I was up in my float house and I'd start up the generator and I'd print out a copy for the person I was sending it to. But then I would also make 10 copies for all other people, for fishermen, for other levels of government, for the industry itself. So I was carbon copying.
You wrote a lot of letters to bureaucracy with the initials DFO.
DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans.
Right. And you initially thought they might be interested in what you had to say.
I did. I really thought, yes, that they were here to protect wild salmon.
But silly you.
All they ever said, yeah, I think back to that time, like that poor woman. All they ever said was, you know, dear Ms. Morton, there's no evidence. They basically were patting me on the head and saying, we got this. You're wrong. Run along and play.
Run along and play. Are you familiar with the Harry Potter saga?
I am.
All right. Did you ever feel like you were dealing with the Ministry of Magic?
I didn't know of Harry Potter at the time when I was deep into that phase of this work, but I did feel like I was at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party because I had ministers say to me, we left the migration routes open for the salmon to get to sea without passing these farms and being exposed to these high pathogen levels. But I would show them a map and I'd say, hey, there is no physical way for salmon to get out of this archipelago unless they get out on land and actually cross the island, walk across it. There's no physical way. And the minister would look at me and say, that's your opinion. I'm like, no, look at the map. There's farms in every single channel. And he would say, yeah, that's your opinion.
So no, we didn't invent alternate facts down here. We didn't invent them necessarily. We probably got them from you guys.
You did not invent them. It's been going on for a while. And so first I became really angry and the whales got displaced by the high sounds they were producing. We had
So much. I mean, you got to walk me through the sound thing. I mean, that is just like when I read that, my blood was just boiling.
Well, so the seals were very excited about all these farmed Atlantic salmon in these big pens, these big fat fish, and they would either make a hole and get into the pen and eat them, or they would just scare them. And so the fish went to the bottom of the pen and they would just grab them through the net. And so for the farmers, this was devastating. They were losing hundreds of fish in a night. And so they tried many things. They tried shooting them. They tried extra fences, like nets hanging in the water. And then they came up with the idea in 1994 to put these acoustic harassment devices down. They were actually designed to produce a sound that was painful to the seals' ears. And they warned the farmers, don't put this down if there's a seal nearby because it will simply deafen the seal and it won't work on them anymore, which is really a horrific thought.
Wait, let me get this straight. The device is designed to deter seals, but you're not supposed to put it down when there are seals around.
Well, not when they're close because you'll just...
Okay.
It'll deafen them, right?
And yeah.
So, as is often the case, the orca, which is a predator of the seals, had the same hearing range. And this day in 1994, I saw the whales swimming past this farm called the Birdwood Farm. And they had their heads out of the water. They were swimming at a 45-degree angle. And I was very confused. I thought, okay, what are they looking at? Because their eyes were above the water. I didn't realize that their ears were also above the water. I didn't think about that. But when I put my underwater microphone down from the boat, this sound just like blared across my headphones and slammed my needles into the red zone and just pinned them there. It was so loud. And when the whales got out of the earshot of this device, they dove and they left and they didn't come back. In fact, they didn't come back until January of this year.
Whoa.
2021.
January. Is this after your book was already in print?
Yes. I couldn't add that in. But,
oh, okay. So, and these were your whales. That's what you came for.
That's what I came for. And of course, you don't know the next day that they're never coming back, and you don't know the next week or month. But a couple of years after, I'm like, okay. There's no whales here anymore. I mean, there were whales, but not the ones I was studying. There were humpback whales, and there were the orca that eats seals and sea lions and not fish. And they were really interesting. They just picked a different way to come and go through the archipelago that avoided direct contact with these seal scarers. And this is against the law in Canada to displace a cetacean, which is a whale, dolphin, or porpoise, is against the law. And yet I couldn't get DFO to do anything about it.
Now, my first question, if I were in America, would be, is there a private cause of action?
There was.
Okay, now we have to explain to the listener what that is.
Well, I think you're referring to a private prosecution taking companies to court.
Yeah, because if the agency won't uphold the law, there is often a provision in American law that allows you to file a lawsuit to enforce the law.
Right. The same thing exists in Canada where you can file a private prosecution through the Fisheries Act for violations of the law. But, you know, I just wasn't there yet. I didn't think I had any power.
You weren't even an activist, really, yet.
Oh, definitely not. And my point, when I said as a girl I read all the books about people that went into the wilderness, I could see that everybody ran into a problem that changed their lives. They suddenly were fighting for the very lives of the animal they'd gone to study. They were talking to governments. They were inviting graduate students to come to their field stations. And instead of being the primary researcher themselves, they became somewhat of a field station manager. And I just wasn't going to do this. So I went into this with my eyes open that I was not going to get into activism or environmentalism. I was just going to study the sounds of these whales. But that's the view of a young woman who hasn't experienced these things, because the whales were gone. And I could either get up and go follow them and abandon the area that I had made into my home and basically betray the animal that I was studying and do nothing, or I could try to fix it. And I think it's because I was living there as a mother and it was my home, that the idea that I needed to fix this settled into me. But it was a painfully slow ramping up process. So the first thing I did was I did science. So the first work I did was I published on the displacement of the whales. And because I can identify every orca on this coast, we knew that they weren't dead. We knew they were elsewhere because other people were seeing them. And then in 2001, a local fish lodge owner brought me two little salmon that were covered with sea lice.
And that here began, we go.
Yeah, that began 20 years of studying sea lice.
Oh my gosh. I what you did with sea lice just beggars the imagination.
Well, it turns out really any animal you study is fascinating, including sea lice. But
we're speaking with Alexandra Morton, a Canadian marine biologist and the author of Not On My Watch, How a Renegade Whale Biologist Took on Governments and Industry to Save Wild Salmon. That is a mouthful of a subtitle. So just how interesting are sea lice? And what does understanding sea lice have to do with saving the wild salmon populations? That's up next on Constant Wonder. Glad to have you along with Constant Wonder today. We're speaking with Alexandra Morton, a marine biologist and the author of Not On My Watch, which is about how wild salmon were pitted against farm salmon up in the inlets of British Columbia, and how Alexandra just refused to quit. And eventually, well, you'll hear the rest of the story. Alexandra, a moment ago, we were talking about sea lice and whether sea lice are interesting and how you got into the business of collecting, dissecting, studying these tiny little annoying, ghastly creatures. What exactly does one do when you start studying sea lice?
I had a 50-foot net in my boat, and I would tie one end of this net to the shore, and then I'd take it out in a big circle, and then I'd jump out of the boat, pull the net in, and take a bucket and take the fish, and then look at every single little juvenile salmon, which were like from 2 inches to 4 inches long, with a hand lens, count the lice on them, and let them go. And this research just showed again and again that the salmon were fine until they reached the farms, and then they got a sprinkling of juvenile lice, and then these lice just got older as the fish continued to migrate west towards the ocean.
Now, an important point here is that lice is actually part of the ecosystem of the salmon, but it's the concentration, the dosage, that seems to be so devastating here.
Exactly. And the fact that when wild salmon go into the rivers, all the lice die of fresh water. And so in the spring, when the little salmon come out, there's no lice on the coast. But now you've got a million. First of all, they're Atlantic salmon sitting in these pens in the Pacific Ocean. And the little salmon go by them. And there's literally, we've done the math, there's billions of juvenile lice pouring out of these farms, all looking for a tender little salmon. And I would see these fish just being eaten to death. There was a place in the archipelago towards the outer edge where the little salmon would get to. And I named that bay the Bay of the Damned, because by the time they got there, they were just lifeless. They couldn't move anymore. They were just lying on the surface. Their ribs were showing. The lice were just sucking the energy
now,
out of them.
This might be a good time to mention the fact that this was a known problem on the other side of the world.
Yes, thank you. So when the fish farms came in and we began to get these problems of toxic algae blooms and putting them in the wrong place and escaped Atlantics in our rivers, I began looking at the scientific literature and realized that there were Norwegian scientists who had dealt with this, started dealing with this 10 years before me. And yes, everywhere in the world that salmon farms go, sea lice get on these farm fish and their populations explode to the point that they kill off all the wild fish around them. What I didn't know at the time is that the same process was going on with bacteria and viruses. And that came later in my work. But the sea lice, I could see, and were easy for me to transition from studying orcas to studying sea lice on juvenile salmon. But after 10 years of writing to the government, I realized the government isn't listening to me. So I invited young scientists to come to my home in the remote wilderness, and I would feed them and tie up their boats for them and give them a place to stay if they wanted to study sea lice.
And now you're managing a field station.
Exactly. Now, it was fabulous.
Tell me what you fed them.
I fed them rice and whatever vegetable was in my garden, which was generally kale and coconut milk. And we called it, my daughter, by then I had a daughter, my daughter called it glop. And this food, you know, kept them going.
To be fair, it was brown rice.
It was brown rice.
Yeah.
I didn't have the money, you know, to run a research station or to support these other researchers. But I was desperate because the number of salmon returning to the rivers was lower and lower and lower. And the scientists in Norway said, you're not going to have any wild salmon in the end because the sea lice are going to eat them to death.
How much did these farming companies know? Did they come in knowing and with the actual intent of destroying these salmon runs?
Oh, that's such a good question. And of course, I have my opinions, but you can't prove what people know or don't know.
Well, you can if you have discovery in a lawsuit.
Well, I could know that they knew that there was going to be problems, but whether their intent was to destroy the wild fish is dangerous legal territory. But if you think about it, the wild fish are their competition on the market. And these large international corporations are not known for supporting their competition.
Tell me about the trip you took to Norway.
Yes. So I went to Norway in 2009.
Let's just note that that all of these corporations are Norwegian. Every Canadian fish farm is owned by a Norwegian company, right?
It's run by a Norwegian company.
Yeah, okay.
So, one of them is now actually owned by Mitsubishi, which isn't helping.
All right. Leave it to the Japanese. So you went to Norway in an effort to tell us
about that. Meet with their shareholders. I wanted to meet with their shareholders and tell them that, look, your profit margin is destroying my neighborhood, our economy, our wild whales. And really, all they needed to do was get these farms off the migration routes of the wild salmon. Just find another place. Of course, that's hard to do on the BC coast because the whole coast is a migration route, but at least get off the major migration routes. And it was interesting. So there was a lot of media around my visit. And on the evening before I left, the CEO of the biggest company in the world was called Marine Harvest at the time, but it's called.
You mean the biggest salmon farming company in the world?
Sorry.
Yeah.
The biggest salmon farming company.
I knew what you meant. Go ahead.
And she said to me, what do you want? And I wish now I had said $1 million just to see what she did, but I didn't. I said, you just need to get your farms off our migration routes. And she said to me, look, I can't do that. I have to make the share price of this company go up 4 times a year. And I can't control the price, but I can control how many fish are in the water. And I need more fish in the water every quarter. I can't take any out. I can't move anything
now,
out.
Now, when this whole farming thing started, they were dealing with by fairly moderate volume in terms of like the density of fish per square foot, right?
Yes. So each farm in the beginning had about 200,000 fish, and they were Pacific fish. They were Chinook salmon.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know.
Which means that in theory, if you got domestic local fish, then any escapees would not be polluting the gene pool.
Well, unfortunately, that's not true because once you start breeding them.
Yeah,
to be
I know
farm
you
animals,
are. You're already doing it. That's right.
All they know how to do is eat. They forget how to migrate and all these other important things.
Yeah. So when she said, I have to keep increasing the density, I mean, that's a huge part of this story, right? The density.
I know. The light went on for me and I was like, oh, you guys just need to get out because they will never be satisfied with 10 farms, 100 farms, or 1,000 farms like they have in Norway. They always needed more farms. And that is absolutely deadly for any ecosystem to grow one organism without limits to the point where you basically choke off and suffocate all the other life around it. And so it was it was very important to me that I did that trip. But what's funny though is the CEO at the meeting, at the shareholders meeting said, you have to get off our migration routes. And he politely laughed and said, I'm sorry to tell you that we won't be doing that. Well, they are doing it now. We finally won this, and they are in retreat.
But you just jumped ahead.
I know.
I want to hear about disease. Because you said you started with lice because they could be seen. And by the way, oh my gosh, when I read, I was halfway through the lice section and I turned to my wife and said, I am not eating any more farm salmon. And my wife said, oh great, something else to worry about. But lice, oh my gosh, the lice are so freaky. But let's talk viruses and there's also bacteria, right? And what's happening, just to kind of paint a picture, is you've got these salmon that have these gauntlets that they run through up from the ocean, through these inlets, you know, these little fjord-like things, into the bays, and then up these creeks and rivers to spawn. And then the fry have to come back and run that gauntlet to the ocean. And it's a fairly narrow gauntlet, and on one side are these farms that are just basically virus, bacteria, and lice factories.
Right. In fact, there's one Norwegian paper that calls them disease factories. So I didn't think I could study bacteria and viruses because this requires you to be a virologist, you know, and I'm a whale biologist, but I was part of a commission in Canada, the Cohen Commission, and I saw the disease records that these fish farmers were producing from their own laboratories. And I thought, oh my gosh, somebody's got to look into this. Is this spreading to the wild fish? And so I found a lab that would work with me, and I basically got the recipe for how you do this. How do you collect viruses? How do you catch them? Well, that wasn't that hard. And so I started doing that and went all over the province, up the rivers, got other people to help me, and produced a paper in 2017 that said this Norwegian virus called Piscine orthoreovirus was spreading to wild fish and that the wild fish that were infected with it were not getting up the rivers. The industry just went berserk over this. And of course, they made fun of me. They said, she's not a virologist. What is she doing this work? But it was published in a very credible, top-notch scientific journal.
Well, my recollection is that you, all with all of your publications, you also brought in top-notch collaborators.
That's right. That became how I did this. I became the field end of all of these projects. And I would approach people and say, do you want to study bacteria? Do you want to study viruses? Do you want to study sea lice with me? I will be the field end. You do the analysis, we write the paper together. And this was very, very productive. And I've worked with so many fabulous scientists all over North America. And But the salmon farming industry denied everything, and they began to slander me and accuse me of sticking lice on the fish and importing viruses from Norway and just like these impossible things with no motive. Like, why would I do this? I just want to have a quiet life studying whales. But this became very dangerous. And so politicians became scared of me. I took the industry to court 5 times.
I want you to tell the story about how you became a peer reviewer for an industry show.
Yes. Yeah, so in 2003, the province of British Columbia decided for 1 year that they would close the farms on the migration route of the pink salmon. This is a species of salmon that migrated through the Broughton Archipelago that I was studying, because the pink salmon populations were crashing on my prediction.
When you made that prediction, they said that was laughable. You said that it would reduce the salmon run there by like 98% or something?
97%.
And they laughed at you and they made fun of you and they said, you have no idea what you're talking about. But you were basing that on the Norwegian experience, right?
That's right. The Norwegians told me if the little fish have more than one louse per gram of their body weight, they're not going to come home. They're going to die. And so I told everybody, look, this is Norwegian research, but if you apply it to what I've seen, 97% of these fish are not going to come back.
And you were right. Then, you were more than right.
Yeah, 99% did not come back to the 7 rivers of this archipelago, whereas on the rest of the coast, they were doing fine. And this touched off alarm bells. This was before everybody got into their little trenches and started to fight this problem in the media. But the government decided they would do a test and they would close the farms. And oh my gosh, so there were no lice and the survival of that generation of fish was just astronomical.
And so this was a one-year experiment.
A one-year experiment. And a DFO scientist wrote a paper about it. He wrote a paper on how these salmon had survived so amazingly well among the salmon farms. He completely left out the part about the fact that those farms had been taken out off of their migration route. And the journal sent this paper to me for review because I had by then published several papers on sea lice. I was an expert on sea lice in North America. And I said, no, you can't publish this paper unless he talks about the fallow route that was created to allow these fish to go to sea with no lice. And this man denied it and denied it and denied it. This is a very senior DFO scientist. And finally, the journal said to me, look, you're going to have to reveal who you are, because the scientific process of review is always anonymous and it allows scientists to speak freely without fear of ramifications. And so I did. And as soon as I revealed myself, he said, Oh, yeah, there was a fallow in the spring, but I was talking about the fall. No, he wasn't, because juvenile salmon aren't going to sea in the fall. And so the journal corrected it and the paper got published.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking with Alexandra Morton, the author of Not on My Watch: How a Renegade Whale Biologist Took on Governments and Industry to Save Wild Salmon. We're going to turn next to some conversations that Alexandra had with some government officials who contacted her and arranged a secret meeting because they didn't think that their superiors were going to be handling this on the up and up. Constant Wonder will be right back. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking with Alexandra Morton, the author of Not on My Watch: How a Renegade Whale Biologist Took on Governments and Industry to Save Wild Salmon. She is a marine biologist who has lived for years and years in the inlets and much of her life actually on the water in the inlets of British Columbia. Alexandra, I wanted to ask you about the motives. You know, we've seen some of the weird contortions that people in the government went to in order to accommodate the industry. Do you have any impressions about the motives for this behavior?
This was a big question to me because I had trouble believing what this was going on, but I got hit with it so many times. I began talking to some people in government who were just as worried as me. And they said they were not allowed, their information was not reaching the ministers. It was being covered up and suppressed.
They reached out to you and you had this like secret meeting with them.
I did, because I was so amazed somebody in government actually agreed with me, because everybody else was saying, oh, you're crazy, you're a hysterical woman, blah, blah, blah. But then in Canada, we have an Access to Information Act. And so you can actually order the conversations of government employees on the internet. You just give the dates, the names, the subject matter, and you send this off to the Access to Information folks, and you get back sometimes 100 papers. I got one back that was 10,000 pages. And so I actually got to read their emails to the companies, their emails to each other. And they were doing everything they could to deny what I was saying and other researchers. They were covering up research that was showing, for example, that this virus was from Norway and causing disease. They were denying the sea lice, and they were practicing developing the lines between them, their media lines. They never said, uh-oh, this is a problem, all hands on deck, here's what we're going to do about it. And honestly, that's all I was waiting for. I did not want to derail my entire life chasing this thing. It was like, I felt like I was a mom with a baby. I was just trying to give it away, leave it on a doorstep where somebody would take care of it. Would somebody deal with this problem?
Yeah, but you would never let go. And one of the crazy things in the story is how at every iteration of failure, you would say, okay, what next? And then you would just take it up a ratchet.
Yeah, that's what they did not calculate for with me. So, after my science being denied, after winning all these lawsuits and nothing changing, I thought, okay, maybe I need to start with activism now. And so I did a number of events. I walked hundreds of kilometers down the Vancouver Island, through all the towns with signs. And when I got to the Parliament building, there were 5,000 people with me, but it did nothing. And then I did a canoe trip with 100 people, and we walked through the streets of Vancouver with a huge crowd to this commission on why the Fraser River sockeye were collapsing. That helped a little bit, but still nothing. And finally, in 2017, myself and the
local
First
like
Nation,
a 25-year-old saga at this point, right?
Yeah.
Is 25 about right?
It's 35 now.
35.
Yeah.
You mean since you first became aware that the farms were causing disease in the salmon run? 35 years.
It's 35 years since the fishermen came to me and said,
since
hey,
the fishermen
putting
came
these
to you.
Things in all the wrong okay. places, which right. I didn't understand what they were saying at the time.
Okay. But, so now you were going to tell us, finally, I interrupted you, but you were bringing us up to speed like in 2017.
Yeah. Finally, we just occupied the farms. For 280 days.
Wait, how did you occupy them? You also had a lot of run-ins with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which are kind of funny. but was this before? Were you occupying the farms at a particular juncture where they were like denying the disease that was there? What was the instigation there? What was the
First Nations of that archipelago, indigenous people who had been there for 10,000 years, they had never said yes to this industry. And in Canada, First Nation governments are a federal government. They are recognized by the courts as a federal government. And so they kept saying, no, we do not want this industry here. We are now really worried about our wild fish because, you know, they got down to like 0.1%. of the wild fish they used to have. And we knew that in June of 2018, all of the provincial tenures, sort of the rental agreements with the province, were all going to expire. And so one young First Nation, actually a kindergarten teacher, but also a hereditary chief, Ernest Alfred, he decided he was just going to stand on a farm until it left. He didn't really think it through, but somebody else joined him, a young woman named Carissa Glendale. And then another group got, another tribe got on a farm. And
I don't understand. You mean they're physically, are they bringing food, blankets? What are they doing?
Physically on the farm with tents and sleeping bags. And we brought them food. And then we brought them lumber.
When you say on the farm, the farm itself is in the water. You're talking about the shoreline next to the farm?
No, the farm is in the water and they're on the farm, which is these narrow aluminum walkways. It's about the size of a football field. And these walkways are arranged in big squares. And inside the squares, the nets hang down 60 feet or so. And the fish are in there. And so they were living on these narrow walkways that were just big enough for like a pup tent to be set up. And nobody thought this was going to go on for 280 days. I mean, it ended up being winter and snow, and it's really uncomfortable. And lots of the people occupying the farms were young First Nation women, and I was so worried about them. The company had an injunction against me already for going on the farms, and so I was just rafted to it in my speedboat. But finally, I decided, okay, I should probably occupy a farm myself and try to bring this thing to a head. And so I did that. I stepped onto a farm, and there was RCMP there, and they were putting Atlantic salmon into a pen that were infected with this Norwegian virus. And RCMP were wearing, like, bulletproof vests and goggles and had guns, and they were about the age of my son. And I just said, You guys are way overdressed for this.
Yeah, well, they said, we're going to arrest you, right?
They said they were going to arrest me.
And you said, go ahead.
Yeah, I said that's what I was there for.
In fact, you said, then you can throw me in your Zodiac and we'll have a scene here.
Yeah, so the RCMP said to me, how do you see this going?
Yeah.
And I said, arrest me, put me in your black Zodiac and take me to town. And what they did instead was they left. They left me there with the fish farmers on a farm in a rising storm in Knights Inlet, which is an incredibly wild place. And I was not dressed for this. I was dressed for getting arrested. But a friend was nearby and he threw me a garbage bag, and in it there was a tent and some water and a big sweater and some applesauce and a couple of granola bars. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to get off this farm. They think I'm going to just run away because the police protection is gone now. And nope, I wasn't going to do that. So I sent out a message on Facebook that I was on the farm that was like barely in cell phone range, but that was my protection. People now know I'm here. And I was going to sleep in this little greasy shed with a generator in it. And as soon as it got dark, I heard a speedboat coming towards the farm fast, and I was really frightened. But then I hear laughter. Oh, it was the First Nations Sherry and Ernest and Carissa and Julia, and they came with tents, and they're like, yeah, we're, I said, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, you're not going to do this alone.
And this is in the midst of a winter storm?
This is in the midst of, it wasn't a big storm, but it was when the wind was rising. Yeah, so it was getting rough. And it was dark. I mean, it was amazing they got there. And let me tell you, that's just an incredible feeling when you're on the front lines and people step up behind you, because you never know. When you're on the front lines, you just cannot rely on the thought that somebody will be there for you. You have to be prepared to do this yourself. But there they were. And then the next year, the industry hired a company called Black Cube.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about this one.
So suddenly boats, aluminum boats with blacked out windows began to follow me everywhere I went in my boat. And they had cameras, and a fisherman phoned me, and his kid had answered a advertisement for employment that was posted online. And he said, Alex, you're not going to believe this. This company named Black Cube is hiring people to go out on the water, and they are going to be doing surveillance. And he said, I think this is about you. And so I looked up the company Black Cube online, and well, when I saw the website, I thought it was a joke. I thought this was maybe like a video game or something. It was so sinister. But this is a company of ex Israeli military who help corporations that have legal problems. Well, Maui definitely had legal problems. They were suing me. I was suing them. The First Nations were suing them. They were suing First Nations. You know, they also had things like at the farms, they had signals, open Wi-Fi signals, and my, you know, Apple computers are a little bit too friendly and they'll link up, and mine did. And my whole hard drive of photographs for that summer went down. They denied that this was the Black Cube, but they had taken a business license out in the local town for Black Cube. So
It was the other Black Cube. Hey, tell me the story about when you got a friend to dive 80 feet down to test the effluent for disease. That was a crazy story.
Right. So these farm salmon, they, you know, when they kill them and take them to market, they go to a processing plant and they gut them and wash all the blood. And the blood just was going straight into the ocean. Probably still is. But my friend Tavish Campbell dove down and put a plankton net over the end of the pipe. And when he brought it up, there was live sea lice pouring out of there, but there was also live virus.
And the important thing here is that this was actually in a more in a pristine part where they were not even doing the farming. They had trucked these across land, and now they were infecting a pristine area.
Right, and not only pristine, but where the entire Fraser River salmon population had to migrate by. So this is the biggest salmon river in the world. And the footage that he got was unbelievable. It was this plume of blood just like squirting out into the ocean down there with twinkling of scales. And of course, you can't see the viruses, but I sent the samples to the lab and there it was.
Okay,
it was
so they made a second dive, and there was nothing going on.
Yeah, well, so they would, if the company saw the boat there, they began to turn off the pipe. And so these guys had to keep the boat around the corner and then dive down and then, like, hand over hand, crawl along the bottom of the ocean. And whoop, there's the pipe again, pumping this blood out.
Oh,
and not only in this location, but on the opposite side of Vancouver Island, the same thing was happening. And they just denied it. They denied it was coming from the factory. They said this was rainwater from the storm drains on the roads. But no, it's full of scales.
All right. This book is full of stories like this and more. But let me just go ahead with 3 minutes. You've kicked them out. But the real objective is to get them on land in tanks, right?
Personally, I don't care what they do.
Okay. But
if they want to farm salmon, yeah, there's totally this option of putting them on land. This is the fastest growing part of the aquaculture sector in other parts of the world,
right?
In the US, in Japan, in Norway. They're moving onto land because they protect themselves from disease and high water temperature and algae blooms.
So what's the disposition now, though? I am almost out of time, but tell me where it stands, because I read the whole book just going like it's a crime thriller and I got to find out what happens in the end. You want people to know. So tell us, you're going to give us a spoiler.
Right. So the story is still going on. But today there are 38 salmon farms of the 100 that were on this list that are closed or are going to be closed.
Okay. 38 of 100.
First Nations have taken control over a lot of these farms and are testing the fish, and they have cameras in the farms. And there's many populations of wild salmon that are now going to sea with no sea lice. So I'm holding my breath that there's enough of them, because we also have high water temperatures and many other things that are now hitting them. But my hope is that these wild salmon populations will reestablish, and the First Nations governments are looking after them.
Okay, so is DFO reformed and chastened?
Well, the Minister of Fisheries, who's political, she changed her mind. She could see the scandal that I had published in this book. Mm-hmm. But the DFO senior management are going in the opposite direction, and they're still trying to cover up and hide what is going on. So we're still working our way through this. But for the salmon farming industry, it's over. And in the U.S., if you want to eat salmon, there's a lot of Alaskan salmon, because Alaska never let the farms in.
Yeah.
So eat Alaskan salmon.
Yeah. Well, we do.
Good.
All right. Well, that's probably a good place to wrap up with the addendum that your orcas returned this January, which is, you know, that's something.
Yes. And they came back in July. And for me, that is just the greatest reward possible.
I assume that means that the sound harassment has been stopped.
The sound harassment stopped, and, yeah. and in fact, the farms that were doing it are gone.
They're okay.
simply gone
okay.
now.
All right. Okay.
It's amazing.
We've been speaking with Alexandra Morton, the author of Not on My Watch, How a Renegade Whale Biologist Took on Governments and Industry to Save Wild Salmon. It is a wild story. Alexandra, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Constant Wonder, it's a well-known story, the looting of cultural goods during colonization. We'll never know the full scope of what was raided from just along the Nile, for instance. But the looting was hardly limited to Egypt. The Western world today is debating what can be done to right the many wrongs.
The debate has moved very fast in the last 4 or 5 years. In 2017, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, was visiting West Africa, and he made an extraordinary speech, really, about how it was no longer acceptable that so much of Africa's heritage was in European museums. This had to change. And then he commissioned a report, which came out the next year, which I think was much more radical than many people expected. It pertained specifically to French museums, but it sent shockwaves, I think, through European museums, and particularly Britain and Germany, the other great colonial powers implicated in this process. And then, of course, in the summer of 2020, we had Black Lives Matter, which, and of course, in the United States, you know, I suppose it's driven by police brutality, police racism, and that's sort of the dynamic. In Europe, the manifestation, as it spread east across the Atlantic, was slightly different, and I think it tended to be more of a laser focus on the colonial era and the bad things that happened during the colonial era, and in what way there can be redress or restitution. And the Benin bronzes have become emblematic of this debate, I think, because they are so magnificent. There are so many of them. They are amongst Africa's greatest pieces of work. But also the circumstances in which they were taken in 1897, relatively recently, was so egregious and so well documented.
The story of the magnificent pieces of Nigerian art called the Benin Bronzes, after the news here on Constant Wonder.